Good morning and welcome to Focus 80, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Scientists are often called on to advise government in the process of making policy. Sometimes there are scientists that are actually employed by the government, working for government agencies. Sometimes they are those from outside, independents, or people who work in universities and colleges across the country. For a couple of years now, at least, though, there have been a growing number of scientists that have complained that the Bush administration has actually suppressed or distorted scientific findings when these findings conflicted with the administration's political agenda. This morning, in this first hour of the show, we'll talk about some of the consequences of this clash between science and politics. And our guest is Dr. Francesca Griffo. She is senior scientist and director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Before coming to the union, she was at Columbia University, where she directed the Center for Environmental Research and Conservation Graduate Policy Workshop, and also ran the Science Teachers Environmental Education Program. Before that, she was director of the Center for Biodiversity and Conservation, and also a curator of the Hall of Biodiversity at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. She has a PhD in botany from Cornell, and also holds adjunct appointments currently at Columbia and Georgetown University. She's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But anyone listening can certainly join the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or you might be happening to be listening over the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line that we have, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Griffo, hello.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, thank you for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I am sure that this kind of thing that you're talking about here is not new, that previous administrations did engage in the same activity. When they had some kind of position, they spun data to try to support that position. Do you actually have good, hard data to support the contention that somehow this administration has done it more than previous administrations?
It's a hard question to answer because obviously people weren't tracking it in previous administrations. So to make an exact numerical comparison is difficult. I think it also depends on the exact definition that you use when you say spin data. And I think that's a distinction that's worth spending a minute on early on, because it is a point of confusion often. We are not concerned about fair, open debate. You know, that's a part of democracy. We welcome that. I mean, every scientist puts their data out there. It should be challenged. It should be discussed. It should be, you know, discussed to no end as part of our governmental processes. What we are working on, and specifically very concerned about, is the changing of this information before it even reaches the policy arena. It's a big difference.
So you're talking about the case where a scientist prepares a report on a particular issue for the government and then hands it off to somebody else before that is published and made available to the public. You're saying that somebody is going through the report and either crossing things out or changing things to fit what they would like the case to be. That is, if they are wanting to take one position or another, they're going to look for things that will support the case. And if there's something in that report that doesn't, before it goes out, they're just taking it out.
Exactly. I mean, that's one way that this is happening. I mean, there are several ways that this is actually going on. I mean, that is one of them. But we also are seeing, what I think you're referring to is the censorship and suppression. But we're also seeing the dissemination of inaccurate science-based information, and another huge area is the manipulation of scientific advice.
Also, I suppose that it is the case, and I know that there have been a number of scientists saying that they were they're feeling that they could speak freely was hampered with the government saying to them, we don't want you talking to the press, or anytime somebody who works, say you have a particular agency, you say anytime someone works for this agency, before you talk with a reporter, you have to clear this with the press people. There's got to be somebody there that is there. They're also seeming to be trying to put constraints on the ability of scientists to actually talk about their work.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, to get back to your earlier point of, you know, is this different from previous administrations? You know, we are not suggesting that previous administrations never did this. I think what we're really saying is that right now we're seeing a lot more of it, and we're seeing it across many, many different fields, not just a few controversial places, but across the board, across many agencies, across many different issues. And, yeah, I mean, it's the other thing I would add is that we have quotes from a number of high-level officials in previous administrations, previous Republican administrations, who are telling us that it just wasn't like that for them. So I want to stress that this is not a partisan issue. It's simply we're focused on now because now is when it's happening.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I should mention, too, that for people who are interested in looking at this issue and the concerns of the Union of Concerned Scientists, you can go to their website, and there's a lot of information here on the subject there. We're talking here a little bit in the abstract. Let's mm-hmm. give a concrete example of what it is that you're talking about.
There are so many across many fields, as I've said, and I think one of the more recent ones that's come up is the Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee. And you might say, who cares? What is that? But essentially what they are is they review a portion of EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and right now what they've been looking at is particulate matter air pollution. And they met to review the health impacts of particulate pollution and to make recommendations about safe exposure levels. And how they do this is, in this particular instance, they looked at over 2,000 peer-reviewed studies. They pulled all that information together. And then before they even finished their report or could release it, the Environmental Protection Agency set the standards much, much higher than the recommendations were. And even after the recommendations came out, you know, nothing changed. And I think what's really interesting about this is the first time in 30 years that the EPA has not taken the advice of this advisory committee. Just to say, why does this matter to people? The Harvard School of Public Health estimates that the weaker regulations will lead to about 3,000 additional deaths per year from respiratory problems.
So here is a particular case where there was a panel of scientists that was in position there to advise the government, and the government, this particular government agency, simply ignored what it is that they had to say.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And yesterday, for example, I was in a meeting with a number of gentlemen who run advisory panels for the Food and Drug Administration. And the stories, you know, that they were telling me were just unbelievable in terms of the way that those panels are not able to get at, you know, giving Americans the best advice that they can get on these issues. They discussed things like, you know, stacking of the panels with people who were going to think in a certain way, not making them an arena where diverse points of view could come out. They talked about limiting access to the full information, that there were instances where the Food and Drug Administration was not giving them all the information that it had about a particular drug. You know, information about selective scheduling of meetings, where they would schedule meetings at times when the panelists who they anticipated were going to be troublesome, i.e. were going to not want to approve the drug, would be absent, and that way it would, you know, move forward. They talked about supervisors at FDA suggesting that the people presenting the information at these panels soften their presentations so that they were easier on the drug companies.
Well, if here we're talking about cases where there are competing interests, then is it your sense that what's going on here is that the administration are weighing in on the side of one or the other interests, and that what is in the particular cases you're talking about, it sounds as if you're saying that it's economic interests here that are driving things. And particularly if, for example, you're talking about introduction of some new medication, then your charge would be what the administration is doing is that they're leaning in favor of whoever it is that wants to introduce this medication, because here we're talking about there's money to be made.
Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, political is a hard term to grapple with. What is political interference? Mm-hmm. What we're seeing is that it is usually, in fact, I mean, almost always, motivated by either an ideological concern or a commercial concern.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example of something that's motivated by an ideological concern.
Well, I think in that instance, we're looking at a lot of the reproductive issues. I think a lot of your listeners probably have followed the Plan B example. Plan B is what we think of as the morning after pill. It is something that was declared a long time ago to be very safe for women of reproductive ages. And yet we went through this process over and over again through the FDA, and including the resignation of Dr. Susan Wood, who was the director of the Office of Women's Health, over the fact that, you know, it just wasn't being allowed to be out there as an over-the-counter medication, even though the advisory committees and the scientists at FDA, you know, pretty much uniformly felt like, or in fact uniformly felt that it was very safe for women of reproductive age. There were just barrier after barrier that was put up to block it. And now, although those barriers have dropped to some degree, it will only be available to women over-the-counter who are over 18.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Francesca Griffo. She's with the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's a senior scientist there. She's also director of the Scientific Integrity Program. And we're talking about politics and science and the charge that many scientists have made that politics is getting in the way of doing good science or of having accurate scientific information get into the policymaking process and ultimately get to people as they're thinking about scientific issues. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that there are some people who would say that here, in many of the things that we're talking about here, there are scientific and technological issues that do have political dimensions. And if you listen to some of the kinds of things that scientists say on these issues, whether they have to do with things like global warming or pollution, environmental pollution and its effect on human health, or stem cell research, that these things do have political dimensions. And when you hear what many scientists say, it's what they say makes it sound like they locate themselves at a particular place on the political spectrum. You know, they sound liberal, and that what this is particularly this talk about distorting scientific information. This is a battle between a conservative administration and the scientific community that tends to be liberal. What this is really about is about politics and whose voice is the loudest.
What this is about is that the benefits and advances that we as Americans have been largely based on scientific findings, scientific results, scientific research, and we want to maintain that. We want to maintain the strength of those scientific findings. And if we alter those findings before they are released, then we are tampering in a very dangerous way with the gifts of science for our society, for our health, for our well-being, for a cleaner environment, for safer things for our children, you know, all the way across the board. After something has come into the political arena, if somebody wants to say to a scientist, I disagree with your views, I think they're politically founded, that is a different conversation. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's democracy. Rarely are policy decisions made only on one grounds, and rarely is that, you know, the only thing we take into consideration, the science. That's democracy, that's policy. This is a very different set of circumstances that we're talking about now.
Can you give some more examples of cases where, again, the situation I'm thinking of where you say you have scientists or panel of scientists who have sat down and reviewed the data, what we know on a particular thing, and then have turned that over, have presented that to the administration. And then what's happened is the report that finally gets issued, either what they have done is they have changed something that doesn't fit with their worldview, they have eliminated something that doesn't fit with their political viewpoint.
You know, there are many, many examples. We could talk about antidepressants and Vioxx and Ketek and, you know, emergency contraception, abstinence-only education. I mean, there are many, many of those kinds of issues. But there are issues with mercury emissions, with, you know, the Endangered Species Act, with the toxic release inventory, for example. I mean, that's a really interesting one, I think, because it's another way that the scientific information is being pulled out of the debate. And I think this is what's really happening now, is that, you know, a lot of people have drawn a lot of attention to these changed reports and other issues. And a lot of, you know, very noble, amazing government scientists have come out and said, this is happening and you need to know about it. And so the press gets it and we learn about it. But I think, you know, when we look at the toxic release inventory, it's a different shade of this. Now, your listeners, some of them may recognize what this is, but essentially, the Environmental Protection Agency requires that, and legislation, authorizing legislation, requires that industry releases how much and how often they are releasing certain toxins into the environment. That has been done for a very long time. That list comes out every year. There are thresholds for reporting. In other words, if you emit more than a certain amount, you have to report it. Now, the end result of that is a wonderful thing. It's called scorecard.org is the website, and you can go there, type in your zip code, and you can know exactly which companies in your zip code are emitting what. Powerful tool, very powerful tool for a whole variety of environmental justice groups and other environmental groups. What is now being proposed is that only happen every other year as opposed to every year, and that the thresholds be lowered so that companies could, you know, not have to report a lot of what they're doing because they wouldn't meet those thresholds. I mean, this is a significant limitation on scientific information getting out into the arena where decisions can be made based upon it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not though a case that that the government is actually if the companies are reporting they're releasing so much of this stuff, it's not a case that the government is going in there and changing that number and making it look like it's less. That what they're doing is they're downplaying the problem, or they're redefining the terms so that it in effect sort of makes it look like it's less, or that it makes it look like it's not as much of a problem.
Right. And this, as I said, you know, as we talked about, you know, what are the forms that this takes? I mean, I think one of the forms that this takes is that, you know, federal scientific information is not getting out. You know, we are limiting our access to that information. We are restricting the flow of information into the policy arena.
And I think also there have been some cases, I think, where it's maybe not so much a case of people representing the interest of the administration saying to somebody who is working on a report, I want you to take this out, or don't want you to put that in, but that can we just, they would say something like, can you just tone that down a little bit?
Well, there are instances, you know, there was the climate change report from the Environmental Protection Agency where, in fact, you know, they did say, take this out. There are drafts of that were leaked that show exactly which parts were crossed out. And at that point, it was Christine Todd Whitman, who was running EPA, who looked at this and said, you know what, this version, with which the political appointees have all gone in and redacted all of this from, has so lost its ethos, so lost its meaning, that we're just not going to include it at all. Because better to have it absent completely than to have this weakened and misleading coverage of climate change in the document.
Mm-hmm. And that, I think, that particular case, as you say, it was not just that there was some scientist who was complaining, saying, look, I was told by somebody to take this out. Would you actually have the document where somebody wrote on there, take this out, or cross this part out, or said,
absolutely,
you know, make this not so intense where you're saying this at this particular point.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think mercury is another, you know, major example in that, you know, mercury is very scary stuff. Neurotoxin interferes with learning, particularly for children and women of childbearing age. I mean, I think we all get that mercury is something that we need to be concerned about in the environment. Well, you know, there was that EPA mercury report that was kept in draft for a very long time. So it wasn't changed. It wasn't redacted. It was just not released, and it was a report that was quite damning on mercury and its effects on women and children. And what happened was eventually it was leaked, and when it was leaked, the EPA, did come back and have to deal with it. But if it hadn't been leaked, I think it would have stayed in draft indefinitely. And what's particularly pernicious about that example is this was happening at the very same time that EPA was considering weakening the standards for mercury exposure. Now, again, where does the commercial interest lie in this? Well, that's very convenient for companies that run power plants, for example, and don't want to have to redesign their emissions systems and, take on that expense. But on the other hand, we have the health and safety of Americans.
Our guest again, let me introduce again our guest. We're almost here at our midpoint, Francesca Griffo. She is a senior scientist and also director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Before that, she was at Columbia University, where she directed the Center for Environmental Research and Conservation Graduate Policy Workshop and also ran the Science Teachers Environmental Education Program. Before that, she was director of the Center for Biodiversity and Conservation and also a curator of the Hall of Biodiversity at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. She has a PhD in botany from Cornell and currently holds adjunct appointments at Columbia and Georgetown. Questions certainly are welcome. You're on the program. Questions, comments, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Scientists across the country, particularly scientists who work in academic settings, universities, and colleges depend on fairly heavily, a lot of them depend on federal grants to fund their research. Has there been some creeping of this kind of thing that we're talking about, that is politics, into the business of who is or who is not getting grant money to do their research?
There have been some instances of that there were some examples at NIH where Congress was actually looking at a number of grants and looking at them somewhat out of context and saying, why are we funding that? Why are we doing this? Our position, and I think the position of most scientists, is that, that's what peer review is for. It's not for the government to go back in later and say, this should be funded and this shouldn't be funded. What the role of government is to design the grant programs, the programs to which we'd submit proposals or scientists submit proposals, and then set up an independent peer review process for deciding which of those are the most scientifically meritorious within the guidelines that the government programs set up, not to go in after the fact and say, this should be funded, this should not be funded. I mean, that is not an issue. It's also a funding issue in what we are also seeing right now, which is sort of this mission creep and changes in what the agencies think is important. And I think anyone will tell you, if you want to look at what's important to something, you look and see where the money's going. And those two things are often very related. And so we're seeing within agencies that funding is being shifted from things that are particularly important to those of us that care about the planet to things that are not so critical to that mission. And I guess the one huge example that I find particularly interesting is NASA. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration, which is a federal agency. And what's happening there is a great deal of funding is being taken from those long-term monitoring programs and other programs that are looking back at Earth and being put into Mars. Well, certainly what we learn about Mars is not going to profoundly affect the way that an administration or the way that a Congress or any part of the government thinks about environmental issues that affect you and I on a day-to-day basis. There may be longer-term gains. I'm not saying Mars isn't important. I'm not saying that space exploration isn't important. It is. I'm saying that when we take the money away from things that look at the Earth, we're also taking away the possibility of knowledge that could really have a profound impact on us and our day-to-day lives. And the other thing that's very interesting is if you go back now and read the mission statement of NASA, you'll see that the parts that really dealt with the Earth have been taken out of that mission.
Well, we have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation here. Why don't we do that? And we'll start
Great.
With someone here in Urbana where we are. It's line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi. just delighted with your guest, and this is something that I have suspected, at least in this administration, for some time. And I guess I have a two-part question, which is, to what degree does this administration differ from previous administrations in the scientific arena? And this is the biggie. Is there anything that an ordinary person like myself can do to either change this or, at the very least, let the administration know that we find this alarming? I'll hang up and let you speak. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Those are great questions. As I said, I think, you know, this administration is doing it much more broadly, much more deeply. The range and power of political appointees is much deeper and broader than it ever has been. And again, if you go to our website, there are quotes from Russell Train, who was an EPA administrator in a Republican administration, from Williams Ruckelshaus, from other high-level people from Republican administrations, that I think will demonstrate that this is not business as usual. And her second question is a great one. Yes, there are lots of things that people can do. I think that if you want more ideas on that, you can go to our website, which is www.ucsusa.org. We have action alerts. We have a lot of information. But I think that it's up to us as citizens to be vigilant, to really think about what's going on when we read something, when we see something. You know, we are incredibly powerful. And two things are happening that I think you can really show that power. I think of it as, you know, the mice that roared, and I think we all have to roar. And that is, you know, your election capabilities. I mean, I'm not saying to vote for anybody or, you know, one person or the other. Rather, what I'm saying is be involved. If you have concerns about scientific integrity, you need to take that up with the candidates. You need to take that up with your elected officials. You need to be thinking about that as we look towards our next presidential election. These are all opportunities for you to really create important change. Letters to the editor, you know, visits to your elected officials, all of those things are incredibly important.
Let us talk with someone else. Next is Bloomington, Illinois. This is line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
I heard a week or 10 days ago that the Bush administration has unilaterally closed down the EPA libraries. And is boxing up all the materials to put them in storage, promise, I put that in quotes, to have the information available for us online, but not beginning to say where. Any word on that?
You know, it's interesting. We are investigating that. We are trying to find out what's going on. I find this to be of great concern, and I think particularly because so much of the earlier literature is not online, and right now nobody has access to it, number one. Number two, so much of what's valuable in those libraries is gray literature. It's not stuff that is published in, you know, the big journals. Rather, it's you know, it's the history and heritage of reports from a whole variety of institutions. Science is based on what previous scientists have done. Before you pose a hypothesis, you know, before you set the questions of your research study, you have to look and see what everybody else has thought about something. So the act of taking away information on which those questions would be based is very, very frightening. Now, I don't know, and the questions that we are looking at are, you know, how quickly is this stuff going to get scanned and available online? I mean, we are not saying that, you know, it's not a bad thing to transition from paper libraries to electronic libraries. Rather, what you want to make sure is that that information continues to be available throughout that transition process and that you're not leaving people crippled in their day-to-day work because they're unable to go back to that information and use it. So, yes, it's an issue. It is happening, and we are looking into it.
Well, this gets at another area, another point of criticism for the administration, and that is its tendency to classify information, to make things secret, and to classify various kinds of information that previously hadn't been classified, and whether or not that makes it more difficult for people to do various kinds of research, and I suppose science would be one of those areas. Is that something that you have seen as a problem?
It is something that we have heard about, yeah. It is not something we've done a lot of investigating of, but our colleagues in other organizations that are specifically looking at those issues are very concerned about this. Classification is obviously critical to national security, obviously something we don't want to do away with in its entirety. But on the other hand, it's very important in a democracy and in a world like ours that is so technology-based to make sure that we make all the information we can freely available.
I think that certainly it's important that we would like at least to have citizens involved in debates surrounding science and technology issues, and that it's sometimes that's difficult because we seem to have a problem with a lot of people don't really have a good basic understanding of science.
Mm-hmm.
And even the president himself has said that he thinks that it would be important for the United States to bolster science and math education. I think his argument largely is an economic one, but simply in the interest of having an informed populace, you would like to see that happen. Is it the case, do you know, that the administration has actually put any resources, any money into that in backing up its support, its verbal support for the idea of math and science education being important?
My impression is that a great deal of this has been rearranging of existing funds, but I think, you know, what's really important here is that we do continue to have an informed electorate, as you said, that we do continue to have access to this federal science, and that, you know, we really just need to get the politics out of science.
Certainly this is something that your organization and other similar kinds of organization of scientists have been talking about now, at least for a few years. What is the scientific community doing about this or trying to do about this?
Well, let me address your first point, which is, you know, that they've been talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
We have a statement on our website that almost 10,000 scientists across the country have signed, and it is still open for signing. Many, many National Medal of Science winners have signed it, many Nobel laureates, many Crawford Prize winners, and so on. I mean, this is a very elite group of scientists, as well as a broad group of scientists from across disciplines and across localities. So they're signing, they're on. What are we doing about it are a number of things. I mean, I think one of the most important things is this ongoing documentation so that we are watching and they know we're watching. I mean, I think the administration has figured out that there are people who care very much about science and what happens to it and that we're keeping track of all these examples and keeping track of what's disappearing. We are also trying to, make policy changes. I mean, we are doing exactly what we are hoping, you know, scientists will be empowered to do, and that is to bring this to the attention of decision makers. We had a major success last year with the Endangered Species Act, for example. There were several pieces of legislation that were going to essentially strip, you know, gut the science of the Endangered Species Act, pull it out of there, and make it very difficult for scientists, for example, to use modeling information and to use a number of other data sources as we consider what's endangered and what isn't. And scientists across the country signed a letter to the Senate saying, this is what has to be in any Endangered Species Act revisions. And basically it was just going through and saying, this is the way we have to think about the science. This is the kind of scientific information on which these decisions need to be based. And, you know, no legislation managed to get passed in the last session. So at this session, although there's a few more weeks, we're not anticipating anything happening. So that was a big success. I mean, it shows you that when people do come out and come together and say, enough, you've reached the line, the science matters, it has to be a part of the decision, you know, stop what you're doing, that we are heard.
And I certainly can understand why scientists would be concerned about this. You have a reason to believe that there are significant numbers of Americans who are not scientists who are concerned about this issue of scientific integrity?
Absolutely. Our website is visited by all kinds of people. Our membership includes all kinds of people. I get phone calls and letters and emails from all kinds of people. People, you know, we sometimes underestimate them, but I think people are very good at making the connections between For example, you know, what's happening with Vioxx at the FDA and the science behind it and their lives. They're not dots that are impossible or difficult to connect. And I think the American people are very smart and very able to connect our leaps forward in public health, our sustained economic growth, even a certain pride about our scientific leadership in the world. I mean, all of those things are values that Americans hold, and they can connect that back to high-quality science. And to connect high-quality science back to science that is independent and objective is really happening, I think, across the country.
We have maybe about 10 or 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, I just want to tell people who are listening that anyone who has question or comment certainly can feel, should feel welcome to join the conversation and dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And again, I'll introduce our guest, Francesca Griffo. She is a senior scientist and also director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. You know, I think that, you know, from time to time on this program, as we've talked about science and technology issues, I think one of the things that we keep coming back to is the idea that it, and I recognize this is a slightly different issue, but I'm sure that you'd have something to say about it. Something we keep coming back to is the idea that it would be a good thing if we had here in the United States, we had more kinds of discussion that involved citizens, discussion about scientific and technological issues, particularly when it comes to some kind of new technology, whether we're trying to think about, well, should we have this thing or should we not? Should we do something or should we not? And it seems that it's something that's really difficult to do, to find ways to get people who are not scientists somehow into this conversation, to have the citizen input into this process. Do you have some thought about how it is that that can happen?
Well, I'll tell you a trend that's going across the country, and I don't know if it's reached Champaign-Urbana or not, but they're called science cafes. And essentially what happens is somebody decides to organize this. Sometimes it's a university, sometimes it's a civic group, sometimes it's a government that says, okay, we're going to take over a cafe for these nights in a month, and we're going to have a scientist from a university come, and they're going to talk about some issue that's of importance and interest to our community, and they're only going to talk for 10 or 15 minutes. And they're going to talk in terms that regular folks without any scientific background can understand. And then we're all going to sit and have drinks and talk, and we're going to hash this around and learn and figure out, you know, what this issue means to us. And they've been, it's a you know, an idea that began in France. I mean, they were Café Scientifiques or something like that, and has really begun to take hold in this country. And the people that have done them say it's just, it's extraordinary, because if you're outside of a university, how often do you really have access to a scientist? Not so often. So I would encourage, you know, some civic-minded person that's listening to try it out, because I think it's a real, it creates a safe, friendly, fun forum for the exchange of ideas about science.
Well, I have not heard of such a thing happening here locally, but it sounds like a good idea to me. Certainly, we have a great pool of scientists who could be the information resource. We have no shortage of them. That's for
exactly.
Sure. Well, we have several other callers. Let's talk with some more folks here and start again with Chicago on our line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yes.
I'm 55 years old, and I think everybody should have a little history on this scientists and their views towards science and politics and the nation at large. It was not that long ago when most of the active scientists were extremely hostile towards any sort of popularization of science, any sort of politicization of it. You were supposed to stay in your ivory tower, keep your mouth shut, and just do your little bit of research. And anybody that stuck their nose out of it was attacked. The best example is Carl Sagan, who was, you know, character assassination, everything under the sun. All my father's friends at the University of Chicago were quite hostile towards what he was doing in his show Cosmos and the attempt to popularize science, let alone politicize it in any fashion. It's pretty clear that the scientific community has finally gotten their head banged so hard by the Reaganites and the Bushites that they now realize that, you know, the very country that they want to do science in is in peril, and they're getting mobilized. And I think that's good. I hope they stay that way and don't go complacent again. You can see the people waking up in Scientific American and Science News and in Science Magazine. You can see that people are really alarmed at this point. I hope they stay alarmed. And I would just say the cafe thing's a good idea, but I have a feeling you're going to be preaching to the converted already. If you look at the last issue, I think it's issue before Science Magazine, this country has the lowest science literacy in the entire industrialized world. Just if you look at that statistic on belief in evolution, there is only one country below us, and that's Turkey. We are really messed up. And you're right, a lot of people are concerned about it, a lot of people are going to do something about it, but the majority of people in America are, and I don't even think you can attack it directly from the science aspect. It has to go into education and everything else. And that's all I have to say. I hope the scientific community stays awake because they were dead asleep for quite a while.
Well, Dr. Griffo, what do you think about that?
I couldn't agree more that, you know, we can't be complacent. We can't go complacent. You know, I think the Union of Concerned Scientists was founded in 1969 at MIT by a bunch of scientists who, as your caller, you know, alluded to, decided not to be complacent, but in fact decided to figure out ways of capturing scientific input into these very important decisions. I guess I'm a little more optimistic. I think of, you know, a lot of what we're doing in schools is actually very well done and very important. But I also agree that there is enormous room for improvement. I think a lot of people are frightened of learning science. A lot of teachers are frightened of teaching science. And I think it's up to all of us, you know, as parents, as citizens, to really, you know, push for, you know, the importance of understanding how the world works, particularly as the world we live in gets more and more and more complicated. This becomes more important to our ability to make good decisions.
I want to make sure here before we end out of time, because you were talking just a little bit ago about the Café Scientifique. Mm-hmm. There actually is one here in Champaign-Urbana, and it just
Great.
Apparently got started this past summer. And for people who are interested, our own Tom Rogers, our news director, did a feature on it, which is on the AM580 website. They have, that is the Scientific Café, they have a website, which is www.cu-cafe-sci.org. And they apparently are doing this on the first Wednesday of every month at 7 o'clock in the evening. And if you go there to the website, you can get the information on exactly where it's happening and what's going on and so forth. So I'm glad, see, as often happens on this program, somebody out there is listening who knows more than I do, and there are probably a lot of people who know
Both
more than
us.
I, and who call in with the information. So again, the Café Scientifique of Champaign-Urbana is on the web, and they're doing one of these things every month. So if you're interested, you know, check out that website. And thanks to whomever it was that called in to give us the information.
That's fabulous. And I think, you know, bookstores and other, you know, outlets, I mean, are so full of wonderful popularized books, you know. And again, when I think of when I was growing up, how little there was that was nonfiction and interesting for kids to read. And now, oh my gracious, you know, there are the children's part of bookstores are just filled with fabulous nonfiction books. And I think the most important thing that a parent can do with their child is to take them out into nature, whether it's a park or the woods or a stream or wherever you can go. You know, take your kids out, expose them to that whole natural world that's out there, and I promise you, they will come back to you with their own little hypotheses and scientific proclamations about the how the world works. And isn't that a great thing to talk about around the dinner table?
Yeah. And this is just, I'll mention that this is that takes place, has been taking place at the Verde Gallery Cafe in downtown Champaign.
Great.
So, again, more information there. You can go take a look at their website.
Fabulous.
Let us talk with someone else here. And we have a couple of people here in Champaign. We'll go next to line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for doing what you do. I wanted to ask whether the Union of Concerned Scientists has taken an interest in ballistic missile defense. I remember a report from the Institute of Physics maybe 3 years ago or something pointing out that I think trying to intercept ballistic missiles during their boost phase when they were detectable was not only extremely difficult, but they were saying that it would not be difficult for people launching missiles to make it completely hopeless for any conceivable system to intercept them. I'm not sure whether this is one of your, but I haven't heard anything about the report or the issue since then, and we're obviously still developing and claiming the politicians are relying on, you know, missile defense as if it were both useful and, not a net harm to international security. So I'm not sure whether this is one of your issues or not.
It is not one of my issues, except as it concerns, you know, the scientific integrity issue, but it is certainly a huge issue for the Union of Concerned Scientists. If you go to our website, ucsusa.org, we have a large and wonderful global security program. And I know there's a ton of information about various aspects on there. If the particular thing you're looking for is not on there, there is a contact us place where you could email them that specific question.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another Champagne caller. This is line two. Hello.
Yes, I'm following up in part on an earlier caller who was talking about this issue of education. I'm just wondering, obviously the scientific cafes are a great thing, but part of the problem, I think, perhaps maybe related to the fact that, of course, the average many citizens do have a very abysmal knowledge of science, but also that in the media, that the media tends to, when they report on something regarding the government, for example, they or various scientific findings, if there's any debate at all, if one person says that global warming is false and another 20,000 say it's true, they will say that, well, there's a debate over global warming underway. therefore, one wonders, you know, reading the papers, the local News Gazette or various other venues, more than, let's say, the New York Times, but you read these and also you watch television and, for example, John Stossel, I think his name is, on 2020, apparently had Michael Crichton on as an expert on global warming, saying it was completely untrue and so on in 2020. And so I just found that mind-boggling. I didn't see the interview, but it, just the fact that he had this person on was just incredible to me. And I wondered if it had a tremendous impact on the popular consciousness regarding a very important issue, right?
Yeah, I think it is very challenging to help, you know, those reporters and others in the media to really understand that, you know, yes, you do need to have balance in newspaper articles on a number of things. But when you're talking about a scientific issue, it's very easy to confuse, you know, a lack of 99.99% consensus with opposing views and not representing balance. I mean, I think, you know, the preponderance of scientists certainly agree, you know, with many, many things about climate change, and more so every day. And I think it's up to us, when we understand that issue and see it misrepresented, to really bring that to their attention. Go in and meet with if there was an editorial in the newspaper, you know, find a scientist friend or whoever else and go in and try to get a meeting with the editorial board and say, hey, you know, this is wrong. They may not know this. They may not get it. Or try to strike up a conversation with or at least a correspondence of some kind with the reporter. They're learning, and the good ones are the ones that are, I think, are most ready to say, gosh, you know, I do need to learn more about this. I may have gotten that wrong. And if you can begin a dialogue, you know, a concise and well-founded, educated, not hysterical, not whiny, right, dialogue with the good reporters, they want to know. They want to learn. They're ready to listen.
I'm wondering whether do you have concern over, for example, the government, obviously this relates to the military, but when they report on the numbers of deaths in Iraq and so on, they, of course, don't say much about what the numbers are, but we hear from the newspaper there's a certain number according to the media and so on. And then, of course, a study is done, apparently, from what I understand, quite scientific study by Johns Hopkins, funded by MIT, and it was dismissed, you know, immediately because they said the numbers, it just can't be, there can't be that many people dying. But apparently the approach was much more scientific than the typical one that we hear from the government. And so I just really wonder what we're getting, how can we understand what kind of information we're receiving in the media.
Well, I think, you know, as consumers of this information, we need to be critical. You know, and I think that is, to my mind, the most important thing about a good education is it teaches you to be a critical thinker. It teaches you to look at methodologies. How did they arrive at these conclusions? Where did they come from? What was it based on? And can I look at that and evaluate that information? And by using that process, really evaluate the, you know, what is the truth, or at least at this point, the most well-founded belief. And I think that is why the scientific integrity issue becomes so critical, because if we are tampering with the science on which all of these conclusions are based and on which our critical examination of an issue might be based, then we are tampering at the very basis of this issue, and we do this at our peril.
We are going to have to stop, and my apologies, we have some callers we can't take, but we're simply at the end of the time. If you're interested in reading more about this particular issue or about the Union of Concerned Scientists, they do have the website, and the guest has mentioned it, and I'll mention it again. It's www.ucsusa.org, and so you can go right there and get the information. Our guest, Francesca Griffo, she is senior scientist and also director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Dr. Griffo, thanks very much.
Thank you. It was delightful.